being very clear on what your problem is, because sometimes the problem that is apparent is actually not what the real problem is.
Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Jesse Green at the control panels, as always, and today I'm delighted to be having a conversation with Chris Robb. If you ask anyone in entrepreneurial circles who one of the key business people, the movers and shakers are in Asia, Chris Robb's name invariably comes up in conversation. Chris has got an incredibly diverse background, ranging from organizing mass participation events such as the Singapore Marathon, Cycle Asia, and even the Sydney Olympics. He was raised in Zimbabwe on a farm, a country that was going through a civil war at the time, and he draws on all of those experiences and brings them back to practical, actionable steps for anyone in business, but particularly in dental practice. We cover a huge array of topics in this conversation. We talk about understanding risk mitigation, how to proactively identify risks and putting in place risk mitigation strategies. He talks about team empowerment and how they handled a complete radio blackout during the Sydney Marathon. And he talks a lot about understanding the correct problem to solve and why so many businesses tend to be solving the wrong problem. Chris draws on so much experience, years, decades of experience as a business owner, as an entrepreneur, and as a thought leader in the space of business as well. I'm really pleased to be bringing you this conversation because I know that everything Chris shares is practical, actionable, and if you apply it, can make a huge difference to your business today. So have a pen and paper handy. As always, take some notes. If you need to, hit pause, rewind, go back. But whatever you do, make sure you capture Chris's wisdom and apply it to your own business today. So without any further ado, here's Chris Robb. Chris Robb, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Thank you for taking the time out of your day to come and hang with us all the way from Bali. How are you going, mate?
Great, mate. Look, wonderful to see you and speak to you again. Really looking forward to having a chat and very excited to hopefully share some useful insights to your listeners.
Yeah, thanks, mate. Well, look, we've had the opportunity to catch up, obviously, most recently in Bali, and we both got the good privilege and pleasure to go to Necker Island, and I really enjoyed the conversations that we had over there. So I'm really keen to continue that conversation today. It should be a lot of fun.
Great times and great memories and lots of great conversations as well.
Absolutely. There's so much good stuff that came from those two encounters. But, mate, you are regarded as one of Asia's leading entrepreneurs, and I know that that's probably a title that might not sit comfortably with you, but if you ask anyone in the know about who the leading business guys are in Asia, your name invariably comes up. And I want to unpack some of that in a moment, but I'm really curious to talk a little bit about your life story, because you've had an interesting upbringing, and I wanted to just explore that a little bit, because I know that each of our upbringings shapes us, and I'd love to know a little bit about your story and how that's kind of cropped up in your business life.
Yeah, great. Look, I'm flattered to hear that accolade. Thank you very much. I consider myself to be incredibly lucky, Jesse. I had a really interesting opportunity growing up on a farm in Zimbabwe. We grew up pretty poor, and that gave me, I think, so many skills which have put me in great stead, not only from the perspective of growing up on a farm and all the skills that teaches you, but not having a lot taught me so much in terms of where I've progressed as a person and as a businessman. So, early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise, they say. Yeah. Certainly, there's a lot of that. I mean, it didn't necessarily make me wealthy too early, but healthy and wise, hopefully. And, it was up out the door, some mornings, 4:30. I was always an active kid. Mom used to sort of say, she'd shoo us out the door in the morning and be lucky to see us by 5 o'clock in the evening, except when we were hungry, we'd come back home. But, you know, watching the farm operating, being involved in it, having little projects. So, you know, my first little entrepreneurial experience on the farm happened when I was about 12. So I set up a little roadside vegetable store where I used to grow fruit and vegetables on the farm and sell them at the weekends and on school holidays to help pay for my school uniforms. And I was passionate about running in those days, and mom and dad couldn't afford to buy me running shoes and spikes. So I kind of funded myself through those. And you know, that taught me obviously the value of hard work, the value of planning, the whole customer service thing in terms of, you know, providing what the customers wanted. It taught me the value of putting in the hours to, you know, to grow the vegetables and harvest them. And it also taught me setbacks. I have a real belief that we learn the best when we go wrong, when we make mistakes. So when I did the wrong things with crops and they died and you know, didn't have anything to sell, there were more lessons in that often than the successful times.
That's amazing, isn't it? Because, you know, each of us, you know, kind of look at the things that go well and we go, well, let me do more of that and I'll keep riding that spiral upwards. But interestingly enough, you know, I think every single person has setbacks in their life. But, you know, the thing that I'm hearing from you, Chris, is you've had the wisdom to be able to sit back and go, okay, well, what's this trying to teach me? And how do I become better at what I'm doing as a result of this setback? And as you've gone through these things, you know, learning about customer service, you know, what the customer wants, planning, you know, how to deal with setbacks, you know, in your business life, obviously you've left the farm and moved on. Have you had some setbacks that you've kind of gone, you know what, I'm now able to draw on that strength, draw on that resilience? And has that been something that's held you in good stead? I'm just curious to understand that.
Yeah, look, absolutely. I mean, you know, what I didn't talk about on the farm there, and it was that part of that was, you know, in the midst of an independence war. So, you know, at the age of 14, I used to sleep with a shotgun next to my bed. Wow. Each morning, dad used to walk about a kilometer from our front gate to the bitumen road to see that landmines hadn't been laid before we went to school. And at the height of the war, there was a period there where probably once a week we'd hold a minute's silence for a former pupil who had died in service. You know, you used to finish school and go on and do national service. And the further I got into school, the closer I was getting to that. So guys who were my mates, who I played sport with, one year would go off to national service. And then, you know, you might see them on a Saturday night and a week later they may have been killed in service. So it really taught me that the value of, so taking this back to business, the value of life, the value of, you know, no problems really are a massive problem. If you have the right mindset to it, you can pretty much overcome whatever you put your mind to. The value of people and relationships and camaraderie, the value of family and friends, and they all come back to a business sense. It's, as you would know, as an entrepreneur and many of your listeners running their own practices, it's lonely at the top sometimes.
Yes.
And it can be really tough. And one of the keys, I believe, is surrounding yourself with a network that can support you, both from a technical perspective, so the right mentors in the right areas, but also, I guess, from an emotional and a friendship perspective. You're going to have those tough times where if you've got family and friends to be able to turn to, whether that's just venting, whether it's looking for advice or feeling that you're supported. And you know, we form this incredibly tight-knit community as a result of the environment that we were growing up in. And let me clarify by saying, you know, I'm not sharing that story to try and make it sound dramatic. As a kid, I knew no different, Jesse. You know, so it was, you know, we moved to a part of the country when I was 11 on the eastern border because mom and dad wanted to get us into a good school there and we wanted to go to the beach more often. Zimbabwe is a landlocked country, so you used to go to Mozambique to the beach. And literally within 6 months of arriving there, the border closed and progressively this security overlay got put in place. You know, we'd got the sandbags in front of the windows and then the security fence went around and then, you know, the landmine threat started happening and, you know, all those kind of things. The town where I went to school would get mortared fairly regularly. And as a kid, the joy for us was we couldn't wait to get out of school the next day to go to the golf course and vacant land to see if we could find mortar fins and shrapnel to bring to school as show and tell the next day. So you kind of like look at it and say, wow, to someone who doesn't experience that, it sounds very dramatic. But for us, it was just a way of life. And the reality is that there's kids and people all over the world suffering way worse than I ever suffered. You know, you look at what's going on in Syria, you look at these poor people in the Caribbean and British Virgin Islands who've lost pretty much everything. Relatively speaking, the challenges that I faced were minor, but they still helped to shape me as a person and give me this ability to be resilient and respond to adversity.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the fundamental strengths for anyone who's going to be in business. You know, the road to success, you know, in inverted commas, is very rarely a straight line. It's often full of, you know, two steps forward, three steps back, you know, a few potholes, lots of potholes along the way. And then, of course, the successes as well. And, you know, I remember listening to someone speak some years ago that the people who truly succeed are those are the ones that can cope with failure the best. And, you know, having that childhood experience, you know, as normal as it was for you at the time and as extraordinary as it seems for someone who didn't experience that, you know, that's obviously given you some great ability to go, you know what, I can get through this. I know that tomorrow the sun's going to come up and we're going to be fine and we'll be able to get through it. And that's obviously held you in some good stead.
Yeah, look, no doubt. And a friend once said to me, Chris, your biggest strength is also one of your biggest weaknesses, and that's that you never give up. and that was it, you know, and I think that came from those years. So, you know, this ability to be able to push through. But as I've matured, I've learned to be able to step back and say, hey, this is a project I should let go. This is a relationship that you have to move on from as your life evolves. So, yeah, absolutely has stood me in so much great stead and given me so many skills.
Yeah, I think that dog with a bone quality, mate, I suspect we might have been peas in a pod on that one. There have been times in my life, mate, when I probably should have let go of the bone a bit earlier as well. But anyway, that's cool. Mate, I just want to just take a few years forward, and obviously you're now in business and you've had this experience of, you know, being the road organizer for the Sydney Olympics, which is incredibly prestigious. You've organized the Singapore Marathon with over 60,000 participants. You've organized mass events like Cycle Asia, all these other sorts of incredibly prestigious and wonderful events. What I'd love to ask around that is, you know, you must have had an incredible team to pull off that kind of event or those events. What did you learn in terms of, just from the team perspective, and we'll unpack the rest in a second, but how did you pull together a team that could pull off those kind of events at scale? Because that's a huge undertaking.
Yeah, look, you're absolutely right. So, you know, by way of example, the Singapore Marathon, 5,000 staff and volunteers and, you know, recruited and trained and deployed in a period of 6 months. So every year you'd have these cycles where, you know, it was fundamentally a year-round project and it would build with a core team and then you'd ramp it up and then, you know, you'd debrief and you'd go a slight lull and move forward. And I think, you know, a number of key things is structure is absolutely crucial. Communication, absolutely vital. So being very clear on roles and responsibilities and how, not only in the planning phase, so there are obviously various phases to a project that big where you've got your planning phase, you've got your implementation phase for a number of weeks, and then you've got your actual delivery phase, which is on event weekend. And all of those require different levels of structure and communication. But, you know, on event day particularly, this hierarchy of communication to make sure that when a crisis arises, and it always does, you know, my approach, I've given hundreds and hundreds of briefings over the years, and my one key point that I make every time is something will go wrong. It's how we as a collective group respond to it that will ultimately determine our success. So, you know, if you throw your hands in the air and say, oh my goodness, we got a problem here, you're gone, because sometimes you have minutes to be able to respond in terms of fixing a problem. So from a staffing perspective, getting the right team in place is crucial. And you would imagine that, you know, with a team as big as 5,000 people, it's inevitable that you're not always going to get 100% right. So having structure in place in terms of being able to deal with that, empowering that team to be able to respond on the ground and do their job is absolutely crucial. And you know, by way of example, so after the Sydney Olympics, which you mentioned, I was the event organizer and race director for the inaugural Sydney Marathon along the Olympic course. So there'd been other Sydney Marathons prior to that, but this was a legacy event along the course, which we actually staged as a test event before the Olympics, and then it became an annual event, which is still ongoing. And within about 20 minutes of the event starting, we had a total radio network failure.
Oh, no.
So we had no way of communicating with our thousands of volunteers and staff across the course, except for the old-fashioned little tiny Nokia phones. Remember the days when I think the only time in history where a man was proud to brag that he had the smallest one of something was the tiny little Nokia phones that, you know, you literally, you know, were sending SMSs by multiple touches to a key. So, you know, I was in the race director's car trying to run this event, which was across, you know, huge, you know, 42 kilometers of road across Sydney. And very quickly, my realization was, we've got a plan. We've communicated that plan. We've trained people. We've empowered them. But there now needs to be an even bigger level of empowerment. I need to trust that team is going to be able to deliver what they have been briefed to do. Are we going to get it all right? Absolutely not. But are they going to be able to respond on the ground? Probably. And the reality was that the event went ahead pretty much without a hitch. There were a few little problems, as you would expect, but outwardly it was a successful event. I got to the end of that and there were masses of voice messages which I never got to, SMSs which had been coming in that I never got to, but by empowering that team to do their job because I had no choice. And again, tying that back to business these days, how often do we micromanage our staff? Do we ask for that extra report? Do we look over their shoulder and ask them, have you done this? Have you done that? What message is that sending to them in terms of your trust and belief in them? And this kind of reinforced to me this situation of on a massive scale like that, you have to empower, but on a day-to-day scale, are you empowering your team? Are you giving them the tools to be able to succeed in your job? Are you communicating clearly with them? And are they clear of what the objectives and the plan are that you're trying to achieve?
So again, there's so many pearls of wisdom that you shared in that anecdote already, Chris. I'd love to pick up a few of them and see if we can weave a bit of a tapestry with those threads. I'm mixing my metaphors, sorry about that. But anyway, what I just wanted to pick up was you spoke about training. And again, I think this is a really critical part because my experience, you know, you've got a background in elite sports, and I know that not only have you organized loads of events, you're also a very active sports person yourself. And so one of the things I've observed with sports people is they train a lot more than they compete. You know, they spend so much time in preparation and training and training and training and anticipating and risk mitigation and all those sorts of things. Whereas oftentimes in business, training's almost a secondary consideration. It's like, you know, welcome to the deep end, don't drown kind of thing, you know, and in you go. So what I wanted to ask before we unpack some of the other things is, when you trained your team, how much training did you give them before you set them loose on the day? And was there some sort of structure to it, or how did you disseminate that training?
Yeah, it's a great question. There was a lot of training. So, you know, the ongoing core team would be, you know, it wouldn't always be kind of classified as training, but you're coming together as a group, problem solving, identifying issues on a weekly basis and sometimes a daily basis. The broader team of the volunteers, that would happen over a 3-month period every weekend where you would bring them in. We would have classroom sessions depending on what their roles were. We would then do on-ground sessions. So, for example, the leaders that were going to be out on the route managing different sectors of the route would be put on buses and they'd go and familiarize themselves with their section of the route under our supervision. And then they'd be encouraged to come back, for example, and say, okay, try and get there on a Sunday at the same time that the event is going to go through that area. and be very clear of what's actually happening. Because if we bring you here on a Saturday afternoon, what's actually happening on Sunday morning might be quite different. So, you know, empowering them again to come and do their own learning, but giving them the background of what it was that was important for them to learn. You mentioned the word crisis. We used to do a lot of crisis management. We used to do that in terms of tabletops. So, for example, take medical. You'd have the key medical providers, the key staff that were involved in that, the police, security personnel, and we'd spend a whole afternoon throwing different scenarios so that we could be very clear if, you know, if a runner went down in this particular zone, how would we get an ambulance in? How would we extract them? What would the communication process be? You go through scenario after scenario in terms of your risk management. We would then do kind of real-time simulation where we would sit with all the key leaders in a room for a number of hours one night, and they would be on radios. When I say a room, we did a lot of our training at a school, so we'd have different groups in different classrooms. So the course guys would be in one room, the finish guys in another, the start guys in another, and we would literally be throwing things over the radio. The guest of honor's running late. It's about to pour with rain. There's a lightning threat. We've had a major accident. There's a fire engine that needs to get access to the route. So kind of role-playing that on an ongoing basis. How does that tie back to a business, maybe a dentist or in your case? Is I believe really important to take that step back and say, well, what are the potential issues that might be able to hit us and how do we deal with them? I think too often it's reactive rather than proactive in businesses. And, you know, to your point, you know, how can we train to understand what those issues are? You know, I do a bunch of mentoring as well. And I was doing some mentoring to a lady who's very involved in a not-for-profit that does amazing work in Cambodia. Basically, we were looking at what their risk management matrix was in terms of things that could happen there in terms of proactively, you know, what could happen if, you know, the government put in new regulations or funding issues or weather issues or all those kind of things. So it's possible, I believe, for any business to put a risk management matrix together and understand every little risk that they might face and how they respond to those. And what then ends up happening is, you know, using our event again as an example, when something happens on event day, and as I said, it's inevitable that you will have a problem of one sort or another, the staff can say, this is what we practiced in the tabletop. This is what we practiced in the simulation. It might not be 100% there, but they've got the level of confidence and they've got the guidelines to be able to respond to it.
Yeah, I love that. There's so many gems in that, Chris. You know, that concept of taking a step back and rather than being constantly reacting to things, but take a step back, proactively identify the potential risks and identify how you're going to handle those risks should they materialize. Because as you quite rightly point out, things happen. And, you know, it's not a matter of if but when. And, you know, touch wood, you know, that, you know, they don't happen, but it's important to have that contingency plan in place. You also picked up another point, which I think was really, really interesting. And I don't want to let it go unremarked upon because I think there's some real wisdom in it as well. And that was the clarity provided for your team. They knew what the outcomes were. They knew what the expectations were, and they were then empowered to go and meet those expectations and deliver, as opposed to being process-driven, they were outcome-driven. And yes, there was a process around that. But just from your perspective running these events, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, systemization in business. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm a fan of systems and processes and all that sort of stuff. But sometimes I feel that they can be so restrictive that it actually cripples people's creativity and their ability to think for themselves and to respond to something that's not quite documented in the manual. How do you go about that process?
Look, it's a really interesting question, and you know, to be honest, in some areas it was quite challenging because, using Singapore as an example, the education process in Singapore tends to be very structured. And it certainly is evolving and changing in recent years, but quite a kind of a rote learning environment. So encouraging people that haven't had that experience to kind of think outside the box, to say that, you know, you can get from A to F without necessarily going through B, C, D, and E is again coming back to that outcome. So what is it that we need to achieve here? And so critical in the case of an event which is totally fluid. You've got so many different things happening at once that you can't literally pull out the plan and say, well, we have to do steps 1, 2, and 3. There needs to be an element of, okay, we can respond to it this way. So to answer your question is, part of it is the person that you recruit on the key team has got to have that flexibility, that willingness to look outside the box. And again, a lot of it is showing examples in a constructive way and also empowering to say, right, you make your decision. One of the things that I think is absolutely critical in events and in life is what I call the power of pause. So, you know, encouraging that situation to take a step back and analyze what you've got in front of you. And sometimes that might be a millisecond, and sometimes it might be 2 minutes, and sometimes it might be an hour, and sometimes it may be days. We had a situation in Kuala Lumpur a number of years back where we had a cycling event that had nearly 5,000 participants signed up for it. And I got a phone call from the police in Kuala Lumpur saying, we have intelligence to indicate that there's going to be a political demonstration on the same day as your event in 5 weeks' time. And it was like, okay, what are you asking me? Well, we think you need to change the date of your event. All right, we'll change the date of an event. We'll go to market. We'll tell them, no, you can't go to market because this is only intelligence. We're just giving you a heads up, but you know, this has to become in the public domain before you make any plans. And what happened is it forced us to have a pause, which was actually 5 days long before the information reached the public domain. And that's an extreme example of showing that the benefit on one level, it's, oh my goodness, we got 5,000 participants, many of them coming from other countries that have booked flights, that have booked accommodation. It's just before Christmas. We want to get to them as quickly as possible. We want to give them the news so that they can make plans. We need to replan, check with contractors, new venue and so on. But I'm absolutely certain with the benefit of hindsight that if we'd responded in 24 hours, which would have been the temptation, we would have got things wrong. And it proved that sometimes when you think that you've got less time than you actually have, the extra few hours or few days to make a really considered decision, engaging with all the stakeholders that are involved, gathering the facts, being very clear on what your problem is, because sometimes the problem that is apparent is actually not what the real problem is. And taking that step back and analyzing that before you then move forward and you know, announce the plan and communicate it and move forward. And one of the things that I've learned over the years as well is engaging stakeholders is critical, but sometimes you need to be quite discerning about which stakeholders you engage with. There can be a tendency in business when you've got a problem to straight away call everyone in and share the problem, or maybe keep it even too secretive. So it's, you know, who needs to know? What's the information they need to know? What contribution are they going to be able to make before you decide how to move forward?
Again, loads and loads and loads of practical advice and wisdom there. And just to, again, to really shine the spotlight on a key point that I think you made here, Chris, I think is critical in business, and I've been guilty of this myself, and you know, hands up for anyone who's ever, you know, made a boo-boo in business. I'll put both hands, both feet up 10 times, million times over. But the thing that I really appreciate that you shared there was the ability to identify the correct problem. The problem that presents is not necessarily the real problem. And I've been guilty of that before. I've had something present and I've gone ahead and solved, in inverted commas, that problem, only to realize that the real problem was further upstream and I hadn't actually addressed that. And of course, it then bit me on the backside and, you know, I had to then attend to it. So again, I really want to, for anyone listening, please underline this point, bold it, capitalize it, whatever you need to do, because it is critical to understand the correct problem that you're trying to solve. Identify that problem. If you've just joined us here at the Savvy Dentist Podcast, we're having a conversation with Chris Robb, one of Asia's leading entrepreneurs. He's got huge experience in organizing mass events. We've spoken a lot about risk mitigation. We've spoken a lot about empowering staff. We've spoken a lot about problem solving. And he's been sharing some wonderful insights around his childhood, around resilience and whatnot as well. Chris, I wanted to go through some other parts of your business journey, because obviously you've had lots of success. You know, clearly to be as regarded as you are, as well regarded as you are in the entrepreneurial space, you've done lots of things really well. And we'll unpack some of the little boo-boos and missteps as well in a moment. But in terms of identifying factors that have contributed to your success, and I know it's easy to look back in hindsight and identify them, harder to look forward, but what have been the key things that you think have held you in good stead as you've gone on your business journey?
Yeah, I think a willingness to acknowledge that I've got things wrong and learn from them, you know, putting my hand up and saying, this is an opportunity, what can I learn from it and how do I move forward? And that comes with maturity. I've got better and better at that. There's no doubt that there's a stubborn streak in me, and in the early days, I probably would have held on to something for too long. The dog with the bone that we were speaking about before, but yeah, acknowledging that mistake and learning. I think one of the things that maybe if I were to do things differently again, I've had a number of mentors which have been amazing, and I've learned from them. So they've stood me in good stead, but I would have surrounded myself with a bigger group of people that were providing that support network. So, you know, to answer your question, absolutely having people that I can turn to and support have stood me in good stead. I think one of the other things has just been in many ways fortunate that what I've been doing has been my love and my passion. And I would encourage, you know, any entrepreneur and businessman, when you wake up one day and discover that you really hate what you're doing, and sometimes you don't always have a choice, but have the courage to look for other opportunities. You know, I've seen friends over the years that have kind of plotted the same path almost mindlessly and reluctantly for year after year after year, and suddenly they let go of this thing that's burdening them, and they become a different person. I think I've been incredibly fortunate that running was my passion, but more importantly, making an impact on people's lives through the mass participation events. You know, I've delivered events for over 1 million participants in my career, and I guess indirectly impacted millions more through the charities, through the families, through the support network. So, you know, it's fair to say that I've been fortunate enough to have impacted millions of people through something that I absolutely love doing. You know, the reality is that some of the best things I've got out of this career have been what I call money can't buy experiences. It hasn't been about the dollars in the bank account. It's been about, you know, sitting on the lead vehicle of the Olympic marathon going through Sydney, the sporting events that I've attended, the impact that I've made on people's lives that I've known about, and probably the thousands more that I haven't been made aware of. You know, so for example, the guy that comes up to me in the street and says, "Thank you for changing my life. I took up cycling as a result of your Cycle Singapore event, reluctantly because I was coerced by my boss. And look at me now on this fancy bike riding 5 times a week, and I'm a much healthier and happier person as a result of it." And there's many such stories like that that give me so much pride and satisfaction way beyond any commercial outcomes that's come out of it.
Yeah. And look, ultimately, you know, I was having a conversation with someone earlier today that, you know, it's all good to be commercial and to make a quid, we get that. But there comes a point where once those basic needs are accounted for, the stuff that really gives joy is not the monetary thing. It's the ability to help other people, the ability to contribute, and the ability to feel like you're making a difference in the world. And I think anyone listening to this podcast, you know, is going to generally be a dentist. You know, people, you know, we sometimes take what we do for granted, but ultimately, if you can give people the gift of being able to smile or the ability to feel comfortable in front of the camera. You know, what a wonderful gift. So that those impacts that you've had there, Chris, I think are incredible. One of the things I wanted to just turn our attention to for a moment, because in business, you know, you read any magazine, you see any newspaper post or Facebook feed or whatever, we often celebrate success. And that's great. I think it's important to do that, to celebrate victories and applaud that. But as we spoke about earlier, some of the true learnings come from the missteps, the boo-boos, the stuff-ups, if you will. And as I said, I put my hand up tenfold because I've created possibly some new categories of stuff-ups in my own business journey. You know, if you could shoot yourself in both feet at one time, you know, I've been able to do that. But as you look back on your journey, where do you think you might have gone, you know what, that wasn't my best idea, and what did I learn from that, most importantly?
Yeah, look, there's been a number of them, and you know, more often than not, they've come from overcomplicating things. So, you know, set up an event, and rather than kind of stick to the knitting, build a whole bunch of things around it, which, you know, don't necessarily add value to the experience from a commercial perspective. The P&L hasn't benefited from it. I think some of my biggest challenges, as many entrepreneurs will probably share, have been in the people space. So getting things right. And there have been times where I've kind of ignored my gut, you know, interview this person, desperately need to fill this role. They're the best of a bad bunch. So rather than not have someone in there, we'll put them in. And, you know, 3 months, 6 months later, you've got egg on your face. Too often leaving those wrong people in those wrong roles for too long, rather than putting the hand up and saying, you know what, this is clearly not working for both of us. And one of the things, I think it's not uncommon for an entrepreneur to say, you know, let's give them another chance, let's give them another chance. And I've had a number of instances where the relief on the face of the person when you ask them to go is almost as relief as much as the relief on your face. You know, there's this, you know, people have this commitment, I'm in this role, I'm trying to prove myself, but I'm pushing proverbial up the hill and it actually ends up being a relief for both parties. And as long as it's handled in a positive manner and there's a good exit and an understanding of what went wrong. Was it just the recruitment, or was it the training that we spoke about earlier? Was it that, you know, from a management style? Certainly I've evolved. I used to be a really bad micromanager in the early days, and I got better and better at that. I think there's still probably area to improve there, but my, you know, management style obviously evolves as you come through. I think it probably a challenge that many entrepreneurs face is around expectation, because it's your own business, because you've got high standards. You expect everyone else to aspire to those standards, to put in those hours. And I think taking that step back and you know, someone else doing the work, it might be to 70 to 80% of your standard, but it's better than you being up until 4 o'clock in the morning trying to do it yourself. That is definitely a lesson that I think many entrepreneurs can take, and I've heard it and seen it many times. You know, your perfectionism is never going to be found in many of your employees.
I'm scribbling down a little note to myself around that one as well, because I've certainly been guilty of that. You know, I work, you know, what some would consider long hours. I don't consider it an onerous thing at all. But yeah, my expectations of others is we just do what we need to do until the job is done. And I forget that sometimes other people have a life beyond working for me, which, so for my team listening, I'm sorry, I get it, okay? but you've shared some really wonderful things there. And again, I just want to make sure we highlight them, because again, they're simple, but they're profound. And one of my mentors is often fond of saying simple is not the same as easy, right? And you shared with us, you know, like resist the urge to micromanage. And as dentists, we tend to be so preoccupied with perfection. And everyone listening, you know I'm talking about you, because you're a dentist. That's what you do. I'm the same. I get it. So I will own that as well. But that leads us to sometimes micromanage. And you've spoken about, you know, when there's an issue, dealing with it up front and early rather than letting it, you know, linger on and then having a bigger drama to deal with later. And you've spoken about ignoring your gut. And you know, I think that there is some intuition. There's a part of us as humans where we can pick up on things and we need to listen to that inner voice. And I really love those little points you've made there, you know, certainly around keeping things as simple as possible, sticking to your knitting. Again, profound wisdom. Mate, you and I had the very good fortune of traveling to Necker Island. Obviously, Necker Island is not in the best state at the moment following, you know, the various hurricanes that have gone through the British Virgin Islands. Yeah, obviously, that's a devastating outcome for the people of the BVI. But we were fortunate enough to not just have the opportunity to meet Richard Branson, but we're also fortunate enough to hang around with some smart entrepreneurs, some people doing some remarkable things. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your lessons and learnings from Necker Island and, you know, what have been some of the key things that you took away from that experience that you've been able to implement and how's that gone for you?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. Obviously, it was a wonderful experience. Met so many amazing people. I've now got the documented honor of introducing myself to a billionaire by smacking a tennis ball into the back of his head.
I was going to share that story. Yes, that's a cracker.
Playing tennis with Richard Branson as my partner, my first serve whack into the back of his head. Hello, my name's Chris Robb. Pleased to meet you. hopefully he'll never forget me and that'll be for the right reasons. Yeah, look, you know, I mean, from Richard, so many of the things, you know, I've been a fan for years, read his books, love what he does in terms of disrupting business, but love what he does more importantly from what he contributes to the world and his passion for doing the right thing. And that was so evident there to me. This fun-loving guy that you see in the media, is that just a larrikin that's built up for that, or is that the real person? You often wonder how real and how fake these people are. I think, you know, a lot of the time what you see is what you get. And that was reinforced by the staff as well. The you know, talking with the staff, the way they treated, the fun they have, the experiences they have. And, you know, I was talking to one of them one day, and they were sharing a story about Christmas Day. And the Gates family were there, Bill and Melinda and their children. And particular staff member was saying to me, you know, it was just incredible. There's, you know, this incredibly successful and wealthy man after breakfast on Christmas Day got the staff together and said, guys, it's Christmas Day. We don't expect you guys to be running around after us. You've served us breakfast. You go off and enjoy the rest of Christmas Day and we'll take care of ourselves. You know, sometimes the kind of the real people, the self-made ones, are real. And I think, you know, that again is one of the lessons for me is, you know, remember where you come from, be humble, and that came up in spades there as well. I think also, you know, amongst that group there were obviously many different personalities and people, and what so often happens in life is that the quieter, more unassuming ones were the ones when you got an opportunity to sit down and have a chat with them that had the most incredible story to tell and were doing some of the most amazing things. So how often can you be kind of drowned out by the noise of you know, the louder person or the louder problem in your business without looking and saying, look, there's someone quiet over here to go and have a chat with, or there's a little problem that's bubbling away on the side there that I'm maybe not paying attention to because I'm looking at the squeaky wheel. One of the other lessons was, again, that passion, people with purpose, understanding what their purpose is and what they're in business for and what their contribution to the world is. There was a lot of that out there. That, you know, a number of people I met just so clear on what they were doing and the impact that they were striving to make. And it wasn't all about the dollars that they were putting in the bank account. It was what their purpose was and what impact they were making on the world.
That was one of the key things I took away too. You know, very few conversations centered around how do I make a better buck. It was about how can I have a better or bigger impact on the world and how can I make more of a difference. And that was one of the key things I observed with, again, that group of people. You know, yes, they're all doing well with their business, but that's, you know, that's sure they want to have commercial success, but really it's about how can we make the world a better place, how can we do something, you know, meaningful and contribute and so on. Mate, I wanted just to finish up our conversation today because you've been incredibly generous going over so much, but I do have one or two last questions I'd love to run past you. And we, as I said, we've gone over a lot of territory, but I wanted to just ask you, this is perhaps I don't mean it to be a tricky question in the sense there's no trick question, but sometimes it's not a question that many people contemplate. The question I've got for you is, you know, you and I both hang around in similar entrepreneurial spaces. We, you know, participate in the same groups. We have some very similar friends and social networks and so on. But my observation is if you look into the broader business community, there's often advice given very, very freely in the world. Some of it's helpful, some of it's not. And yeah, sometimes I hear some of the advice being, you know, bandied around or even, you know, almost as though it's the gospel. And I don't always agree with it. Do you have any particular things that you hear that are being proffered as advice that you kind of go, I'm not sure that that is the best advice for today's world? You know, is there anything that you kind of go, yeah, it might be a little controversial or maybe not so orthodox, but what do you see being said that you kind of disagree with?
Look again, maybe it just comes back to this, you know, in some spaces, the focus on the dollar, the advice that's being given around making a buck before being clear on why you're in business and what it is that you're doing. You know, and there's nothing that specific comes to mind, but my sense is that there's elements of the world that are starting to go through this pivot to recognize that it's not all about the finances and the material elements of it. So I guess broadly to answer your question, that advice that is so focused on dollar, 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 material, 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 as opposed to the advice which is be very clear on what your purpose is, be very clear on, you know, what contribution you're making, whether that be the product or service that you're creating. So, you know, are you, let's take someone who's setting into a new business. Are you going to have a product or service which is solving an existing need, addressing an existing problem, or are you creating something because you think it's going to make you a bunch of money? Yeah, you know, so doing it for the right reasons rather than, you know, it's a bit of a, I've kind of sidestepped the question a little bit, but there's nothing that comes to mind where I read this article yesterday and thought that this was rubbish and I wouldn't apply. But I think, you know, you do see quite a lot still that's just that material focus when I think there's much more opportunity to say, why am I doing it? What am I trying to achieve? And focusing your business and your time that way.
Yeah, excellent. Couldn't agree with you more. Mate, look, one last question as we wrap up. It's a question I sometimes ask, you know, people on the podcast because it gives me a bit of an insight into the influences that have shaped a particular guest's outlook on life. You know, you're in Bali there. Obviously, you've got glorious weather, you know, 365 days of the year virtually. I'm looking at you on the screen. There's tropical plants in the background. If you were having a barbecue and you could invite, you know, half a dozen or how many people is appropriate around for dinner or a barbecue or whatever it is, who would you find most interesting to have a conversation with? They can be past or present. Who are the people you'd invite to dinner to have a conversation with?
Yeah, look, it's a wonderful question. I mean, I've been incredibly fortunate that my guiding light, as I call them, who the light went out about 6 months ago, was my late father's oldest brother who passed away earlier this year at the age of 93. Absolutely incredible man, climbed Mount Kilimanjaro when he was 70 and climbed it again when he was 71. Director of multiple companies, incredibly respected man, helped pay for me to go through university and so many other things. He's been the, you know, the leading mentor that I've ever had, was always there for me. So I'd love to welcome him back to a barbecue. Richard Branson, even though, you know, we spent time with him, you know, would love to have someone like him around. Nelson Mandela, just an incredibly inspiring man and you know, so sad looking in from the outside. Obviously, my former country, Zimbabwe, has absolutely been devastated by a dictator. And, you know, you now see, sadly, South Africa seem to head in a similar direction now. So, yeah, Nelson Mandela. I mean, I'm a sports fan. I love cycling. I love rugby. Phil Liggett is a friend of mine and always love spending time over a glass of red wine with him. He's got wonderful stories to tell. And, you know, another example of an incredibly humble man. For those that don't know him, he's the voice of the Tour de France and an incredibly humble and wonderful man. So, you know, got so many great insights. What am I up to? Four or five there. You know, from a who else would we put in there? you know, from a sporting perspective, some of the great rugby players, maybe controversial as he might be, maybe someone like David Campese, he'd always be there throwing a few bombs into the conversation, open it up a little bit.
You could guarantee that with Campo.
Yeah, a legend in his time, and you know, it'd be interesting to have just to spice things up a little bit.
Awesome. Well, I reckon that'd be a fantastic barbecue, mate. I reckon there'd be a few good war stories, lots of good wisdom, and plenty of laughs in there too. So that sounds like a great barbecue. Chris, I really wanted to take a moment, firstly, to express my thanks to you for taking the time out of your day. We've been talking on and off air for a little while now, and I'm really grateful. Every time I have a conversation with you, I learn something. I always come away from the conversation feeling better, and I know that the audience on our podcast today will feel exactly the same way, that they've learned something, they feel better for the experience. And so from all of us here at the show, I wanted to take an opportunity to say thank you to you, mate. You are a scholar and a gentleman, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time to come and hang with us, mate. You're a gem.
Thank you, Jesse. No, look, absolutely loved it. Great to catch up as always. And like I said at the beginning, hopefully some useful insights. I know it's challenging being an entrepreneur, but like you said, you know, the gift that dentists are giving to people, the gift of smile and many other wonderful things, don't lose sight of that wonderful impact that you're making on the world to your listeners. It's been a real pleasure. Come and visit us again soon in Bali, or hopefully we'll see you in Australia in the not too distant future. But yeah, thanks so much for the opportunity. Really loved it.
Mate, it's absolutely my pleasure. And again, thank you so much, mate. I really appreciate the time.
Pleasure, mate. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.